Today, the fight to stop violence against women in Nairobi's biggest slum. And in Paris, who's stealing all the portraits of President Macron? Living in the slum of Kibera in Nairobi is a woman called Edita, who is shaking things up in her community.
I think she just walked past us actually, and I noticed her immediately because she's very confident.
She walked past you in the street.
She walked past the street.
You hadn't planned to meet her at all.
No. She was wearing this kind of bright purple T-shirt with "This is what a feminist looks like" on it. So, you know, you noticed her. She kind of sashays down the street.
You noticed how all the women engaged her.
Yeah, she's a nice girl. She's always happy. She'll just laugh every day.
She brings the place alive. There's no doubt about it.
She loves to sing as she's going along, probably to drown out a bit of the abuse she gets sometimes.
Because Edita has become a fighter for and defender of women. Violence towards women inside the boundaries of Kibera happens at an extraordinary level.
Most of the men are rapists. They don't get it affects our mind, it affects our emotion, and even personally it's shattered my dreams.
And with authorities seeming to do little to stop it, Edita and her group are taking the law into their own hands. From The Guardian, I'm India Rakison. Today in Focus, the women fighting back in Kenya's biggest slum. Tracy McVeigh is the editor of The Guardian's Global Development Desk, and she and journalist Rod Austin spent a week reporting from Kibera. It's Africa's biggest slum and is on the edge of Kenya's capital, Nairobi.
You've got the Hilton DoubleTree hotels, you've got shopping malls where people are spending money as they please, and then you drive 100 yards down the road and it's the entrance to the slum. People on stalls, selling food, half of it's half rotten. You've got people burning tyres. An acrid smell that hits you the minute you start walking into that slum. You know you're there.
Poverty is absolutely noticeable. You know, people are dressed in very old clothes. There's the colour is kind of drained out of everything. It's muddy when there's a bit of rain. It's dusty when there isn't. But once you've been there a little while, it's a place where you can feel quite comfortable because of the way people are and the way people welcome you and the way people are interested in you and the way people interact. You know, there's an awful lot of people live there. Nobody really knows how many people live there. It could be a quarter of a million, it could be a million, somewhere between that. So there's an awful lot of people moving around. Music comes and goes from different stalls or different people's houses. The noise of people interacting, just talking to each other, everything is so kind of loud all of the time. It's a phenomenally warm, vibrant place.
And on one particular day, whilst you were there, you met a woman called Edita.
My name is Edita Adhiambo. I'm a feminist activist, born and raised in Kibera, happily.
What does Kibera mean to Edita?
She's Kibera through and through. All the terrible things that happen in Kibera have happened to Edita. She was raped as a child. She was gang raped as a young woman. She has two children, two young daughters, that she struggles incredibly hard to educate. The fathers are not around. She has problems with her family. She faces a lot of taboos. I mean, she sums up Kibera in one woman. All the experiences are there in Editha, and she is resilient. She is brave. She is feisty. She absolutely refuses to let her circumstances get her down.
First of all, we must do a training of bodily autonomy. How are we going to appreciate our bodies as women? And with this discussion, at least it built their confidence, and these women started sharing. And this was the time
for
them to...
So tell me what Editha does, because Tracy, you went and you sat down with her at the centre that she runs. Sounds like you were completely surrounded by children. What is this group that she runs?
So she has set up her own feminist group, and there is 13 of them. One is a man and 12 are women. Their victims are survivors of sexual assault, which in somewhere like Kibera is not unusual.
We are lucky to be the people of the same caliber. Like 90% of our members are survivors of sexual and gender-based violence, survivors of FGM, survivors of child marriage, survivors of defilement, survivors of rape, and survivors of cultures that expose women into sexual violence. So we connect easily, and it is easy to fight when you are the same.
So she has this tiny little house that she uses as a resource for all the women she knows in the community. It's a safe house. They bring their kids there to read. They've got a tiny, tiny little library of about 6 books, all well thumbed and handed around.
What's your name, first of all?
My name is Sian Gettys. Uh-huh. And the book that I was reading was about a woman asking her friend how to take care of her child to become a feminist.
Which book was that?
Just a little safe space that they all know is there, and they all know they can congregate at any point, and it's always open to them.
What's the group called?
So the group is called Feminists for Peace, Rights and Justice.
Why did she start it? Where did the idea come from?
She wanted to send a signal to other women and men in her community that this existed, that there was something slightly more formal that actually existed. She also has a little plaque on the mud wall with the title "The Feminist for Peace, Rights and Justice" written on it. And it's also a signal, because about 4 foot away from her front door lives the man who raped Editha.
The person who defiled me when I was 6 years old, his house is here. When I come here all the day, I know this is where I was defiled. I see it. So Kibera is where you wake up the first thing in the morning, you see the perpetrator. It means when we have these perpetrators in the community, women are more in danger.
She sees him every single day. I mean, when you say right across the road, that's 4 or 5 foot of packed mud away. That's not, you know, there's not even a thoroughfare between them.
God.
And that's the way people live.
One of the things that Editha talks about is just how prevalent this is, how much rape there is in Kibera. A small area, a lot of people, but it just, I mean, I can't really get my head around the story, just how it seems to affect everybody.
It's just extraordinary. I can't, gender violence comes up. I don't think I met a single woman who had not experienced it herself.
Really?
Yeah, never mind, knew somebody, experienced it herself. And not just once, multiple times.
Why? Why in that, why did you get a kind of sense why in that area it was so easy to happen?
I think children are particularly vulnerable because you've got such a highly dense population living so close, without doors, without spaces where they can be safe, and children can't be safe. So children wandering around the streets, children being left inside houses because the mother and the father, they have to work. Of course they do. They have to go out. They can't. There's no nurseries. There's no daycare centres. And there is a culture of them then being defiled, as they call it in Kibera, by neighbours, by anybody who cares to walk by. And then women again are incredibly vulnerable as they get older. They're vulnerable again, leaving for work very early in the morning. They have to leave very, very early, so it's dark. And darkness in Kibera covers a multitude of sins. There's no street lighting. It's dark. So part of the work that she does is to try and encourage people to find a way of talking to their children that will perhaps allow them to see that it is okay for them to speak up if they are attacked, that they have a right to their own bodies.
I sense that there's a very heavy stigma around this then.
The stigma is horrific. The rates of teenage pregnancy in Kibera are astronomical. There's a statistic that says 50% of all girls from the age of 15 to 23, 50% of them will be pregnant at any one time.
Wow.
The stigma is huge, and a lot of girls will find themselves thrown out on the street by their parents.
Mothers as well?
Mothers as well, yeah, because there's a huge stigma.
What, for being raped or for being pregnant?
For being pregnant, they're just seen as bad girls. Abortion is illegal.
Yeah, so many people don't talk about abortion. It's a really critical topic. And if I showed you my phone this morning, I was really arguing with women who are empowered. And this woman was calling other women who have aborted murderers. And I told her, stop criminalizing women. We condemn women so fast, and yet we know how many women are suffering.
So illegal abortion is rife in Kibera. Right up to full term, they go to these unofficial pharmacies, they'll ask some trusted relative for help. They'll be given all sorts of kind of herbal concoctions. Chlorine is drunk quite a lot. They'll get abortion pills that are sort of the illegal transactions of abortion pills, and most of the time it won't work. So they will end up going to full term, and then they panic. And so a lot of the full term babies are killed in the womb.
It's just as well, I think some of the ways that Editor talks about it and the way that you're talking about it, it's clear what the consequences are for the women. But what are the consequences for the men?
There doesn't seem to be much. So basically what happens is the hospital patch the girl up the best way they can, and the family will return home. Mm. That develops a cycle of violence in its own right, because then the father or the husband of the raped victim will then have some sort of confrontation or clash with the suspect, and that, you know, that could result in murder on either side. Even when it comes to reporting of a rape, it needs to have the father to say, yes, I want the allegation to be investigated. If he says no, which happens in 70% of the cases, 80% of the cases, then it goes no further. Or alternatively, there's a dark dynamic to it, and that is whereby if the suspect has money or his family have got money, then the police will speak to the family. The family will pay the officers. The officers discontinue the investigation.
Rod, you are a former policeman, former
yes.
organised crime detective.
Yeah.
Did you sit down with somebody from the Kibera Police and talk to them about this?
Yes.
And what did they say?
The officer I spoke to, Nick Silloway, who's an inspector, clearly wants to do something about it, is clearly frustrated, but when you've got a police force that is seemingly corrupt and involved in all levels of criminality, we're talking about from robberies, burglaries, they extort money from local shopkeepers.
Even killings.
When you've got that level of criminality, who protects the victims? Because the victims fall prey to the system. I don't know, a bit speechless.
Yeah, I can see that.
Mm.
So if the police can't do much about it,
no.
Then what, people have to kind of take this into their own hands?
People take it into their own hands, and this is where Editor becomes, to me, quite an important person, because she's one person who's decided, I'm going to force the police to actually act.
We also, some extent, do the police work. We arrest this perpetrator.
Good. You actually take the perpetrators to...
Personally, I've done that so many times.
And does, when you go to detain the perpetrator, do they resist? Is there a crowd, you know, are they going to fight you? You know,
some resist. Let me tell you, you've not seen these women. These women are very powerful. Sometimes also I cannot even control them. When they are angry, they come for you. You'll never resist 18, 20, 30 women. You will stand up and go, and you will do whatever they say.
And the men don't try to rescue
on the way. They can never do anything. These women are angry. Like, it's enough is enough. And we have to do something. Whether you call us names, whether you say what on the way, we are taking you to the police.
So, Tracy, tell me then what Editor and her group do when they hear that there's a rape happening.
So if they hear of an incident happening in the middle of the night or whenever, they will, and they'll be told about it maybe by a text or maybe somebody will come running. They basically up they get and they go. And they go to the house with sticks and they'll bang on the door. Their first priority is to rescue the woman or the child. Their hope is that they will be joined by other members of the community when they get there. And generally that tends to happen, although obviously also the community will turn against them. They'll rescue the woman who's being attacked. And sometimes if they feel they can, they will then take the man, surround the man, and drag him off to the police station.
Wow. How does that generally go down?
It's had its successes. I mean, I think there's about 3 cases in the courts right now that literally Editor and her woman have dragged a suspect to the police station and demanded that the police take action. They want justice. They want proper justice in the same way that any other human being wants. They don't want mob justice. They only go out there as a group because there is nobody else. There's no police force patrolling. There's nobody they can call. So they go to rescue somebody. But it is not their intention at all to commit violence, to hurt someone. They want to take them to the authorities, to hand them over to the authorities and have the authorities deal with them. That is what they want. They want to be policed in the way that any community wants to be policed.
Editor has a very strong message as well, doesn't she? So it's not just this kind of physical intervention. She likes to sit people down and tell them what she thinks.
she does sit people down and tell them what she thinks.
Most of the husbands here listens to me. We sit them down. I talk to them. I tell them fighting is not a solution. The only issue that we have here, it's imbalanced power.
Perhaps they weren't able to intervene and she knows something happened the night before. She will go in there and she will sit down and refuse to leave until the man's had a piece of Editor's mind. And the woman is told in no uncertain terms that there is a place for her. There's a place of safety should she want to go there.
So she's putting a lot on the line, Editor. How does she feel about it? Is it not quite scary?
It is frightening, and I think her security is by no means guaranteed in the slum at all.
I've been threatened on a daily basis. I've been threatened by perpetrators. When you come to our support group, you'll cry tears, you'll cry because these women have different stories. But maybe sometimes I pretend because they feel I'm the only one who is strong. But sometimes when I'm alone, it really affects me. And when I want to fight back, I fight bitterly sometimes. I fight very angrily.
I'm not a doctor or a psychologist, but I've met a lot of people in my career who have been severely traumatised. And I would say that the Editor is a seriously traumatised woman. But she, I think probably the worst that could ever happen has happened to Editor. And I think, you know, she refuses to call herself a victim. And I think when the worst has happened to you, it can, for some people, it can give them a level of strength. Perhaps as well because she's from Kibera, she's of Kibera, she lives in Kibera, she's not leaving it. She loves that community. Mm. She absolutely loves it. Her family are there, her children are there. People perhaps recognise that she is fighting for all of them.
And one of the shocking things about all of this is that it's happening right on the edge of the capital city,
in a country that's seen a lot of economic growth in recent years.
It's notable, even the disgustingly filthy river that runs through the centre of Kibera is not actually polluted by Kibera. It's the pollution arrives in Kibera from Nairobi. It's already polluted by the time it hits Kibera. So it's this, the relationship between Kibera and Nairobi is Nairobi, you know, turns a kind of blind eye and polishes its nice tall buildings every morning and accepts the labour force that goes home to live in Kibera. And it can keep wages down because rents in Kibera are far lower than they would be if people were trying to live inside Nairobi, Maine. So it is, you know, it's a slum, but it's a slum like all slums all over the world. The slums are the urbanisation of people from the countryside looking for work, and the city's only too willing to give it work because they need the workers.
But they're not willing to give it the space.
They're not willing to give it the space, and they're not willing to give people decent accommodation, and they're not willing to look after the people that are building the fortunes of our banks and our infrastructures and our big businesses and our commercial interests and our hotels. And
so for women in Kibera and for women in, I suppose, slums all over the world, what do we just need? More editors, more people like Editor.
She brings about change, and that's what's important about where the system breaks down, and clearly there's a breakdown in Kibera. She's inspiring women to understand their own rights. She's telling the government, telling local authorities, telling local enforcement that they've got to do something about crime, about the rape of women.
I think there probably are, in fact I'm sure there are, an awful lot of editors out there, thank goodness for them, because human beings, you know, we are thankfully incredibly resilient, and even in such a dark place as Kibera, you have, you know, moments of intense joy and moments of intense light, and people like Edita will inspire us, I hope.
Tracy, Rod, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In a written response, a spokesperson for Kenya's National Police Service said there were no policies, orders, or directives to support extrajudicial killings. They said police officers in Kenya are expected to operate in accordance to the rule of law. Those officers found flouting the law are prosecuted like any other citizen, without any special consideration. This report on Editor and her work is from a new series called Living in Kibera, which digs deep into corruption, gangs and life inside the slum. It's all from our global development desk at theguardian.com. And don't forget to let us know what you think of Today in Focus. Do leave us a comment or review wherever you're listening. Coming up, why Emmanuel Macron's image is disappearing from French town halls. Now, there's a new wave of civil disobedience in France over the climate crisis, and this one involves the removal of over 100 pictures of the president, Emmanuel Macron. The Guardian's Paris correspondent, Angélique Chrysaphis, has been following this unusual but fast-growing movement.
It was a quiet Monday afternoon at the town hall of Lingolsheim near Strasbourg in Alsace. It was extremely hot. And it was about 4 p.m, and something extraordinary happened. 11 people came in. They walked into the committee room that's usually used for council meetings, and they very carefully took down the official presidential portrait of Emmanuel Macron. They put it in a special protective bag, and they walked out of the door with it. After they'd taken it, they said, "This blank space that we've left on the wall symbolises the void in government policy on the climate emergency." So this portrait activism, this campaign to, as it's called, take down Macron, has been happening at hundreds of town halls across France. is happening in the months leading up to the G7 summit in Biarritz in August, in which Macron is trying to position himself as a leader on the climate emergency, bringing other leaders, such as Donald Trump, more into line with what he wants to do and his promise to make this planet green again. There's been a long history of civil disobedience in France over the climate and society issues, particularly in the past decade. We've seen the activist José Bové, who was a farmer, with many people pulling up genetically modified crops. And then around 5 years ago, there was a very effective, if somewhat unusual, movement to take chairs from bank branches. And this idea was to show that if we crack down on tax evasion in the financial sector, then you could fund more proper green transition on the environment. The people who are taking down the portraits say that this is non-violent, but that's not how the police and the government see it. Now, the presidential portrait in France is hugely symbolic. After taking office, each president poses in their own style of photo. Emmanuel Macron's is a very strong portrait with him standing against his desk. Now, the activists say, well, look, this framed portrait only costs about €8.50. It's worth nothing. But the government says it's a hugely symbolic part of the Republic. One judge asked an activist, don't you think what you're doing could be seen as an attack on the authority of the state? And he said, I hope the authority of the state is more than just a picture hanging on the wall. Internationally, Emmanuel Macron is seen as a vocal champion of fighting to tackle the climate crisis, and he presents himself as a guarantor of the United Nations Paris Climate Accord. But the problem is that in France, there's a gap between this great ambition and the reality. And even advisers appointed by the government itself are warning that France is not reducing its greenhouse gas emissions fast enough. Emmanuel Macron has so far faced down a lot of protests, from the 8-month protest by the Yellow Vest anti-government campaigners to all sorts of climate demonstrations, from young people marching in the streets to charities threatening court action. And he claims that he's on the right road to dealing with a climate crisis. His line is, leave us to it, we're making progress. Protesters don't agree with that. And they've been meeting this week to plan future actions. And they're saying that civil disobedience in France over the environment is only going to grow.
That's all for today. My thanks to Angelique Chrysaphis and to Rod Austin and Tracy McVeigh, and to Editor. Today's programme was produced by Joshua Kelly and Rosie Gillett. The sound design is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll see you tomorrow.